Hear us, our Lord, as we pray, saying, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen. Okay. Welcome to the May edition of Coptic Apologetics 2013. Our topic, as you can see on the screens that are working today, is miracles. So, just a couple of housekeeping things to mention. This not being the last Sunday of the month, because next Sunday, of course, is Palm Sunday, and we'll have the Baschas on in the evening, so we had to bring it back by a week. I think most of our atheistic free thinkers are not going to be coming probably tonight, because they have their monthly meeting on the third Sunday of every month. So I'm guessing they're having their meeting today. So it looks, unless someone else comes along, we're probably going to be mostly Copts today. That's all right. Copts are the nicest people. Egyptians, of course. Okay, so today we're looking at the topic of miracles. Before we start, can I just get a quick survey? I was talking with some of you earlier. Raise your hand if you believe you have personally witnessed a miracle at some time in your life. Anybody at all? No? No one? Okay. No, probably, we're talking about physical miracles today. Amazing things happen every day. We all have those. We all experience those. Okay. All right. Well, I was actually saying I believe I've seen two things that might qualify as a miracle. We're going to talk about them a bit later on. But before we do, here's what we're going to do today. Once again, split into two sessions with a break in the middle. We're going to have a look at what a miracle is, which turns out to be surprisingly difficult to pin down, but we're going to have a good go at it. And how do we evaluate an alleged miracle? And then we'll have a bit of a chance to discuss that, those two topics. Then we'll have a break, then we'll come back and look at one particular miracle, which is the apparition of St. Mary at Zeytun in the late 1960s, which has some very unique features. And then after that, with some more discussion, we'll basically finish up. So that's our menu for today. So let's begin with what is a miracle. Would anyone like to have a bash at defining a miracle? What would make you say something is a miracle as opposed to something that is not a miracle? There are many things in life which are strange, which are odd, which are rare and unusual. We don't think of all of them as miracles. Yeah, have a go. Anyone? Go ahead. Right. Preferably, yes.
Anything that's not defined by the laws of nature?
Like. Okay. So things that don't follow the laws of nature,
yeah,
basically.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Anyone want to disagree or agree or add to it? Yeah, Mina, go ahead. Wait until the microphone comes to you.
Yeah, I think it was a bit tricky to define, but something where where God directly intervenes with the situation.
Okay, so we've got two things now. It goes against the laws of nature, and the agent causing it is God.
Well, I'm not sure if it necessarily has to go against the laws of nature, because God could use the laws of nature to do a miracle, perhaps. I'm not sure if that's absolutely necessary. But
okay, if God did something using the laws of nature, would you call that a miracle?
What does somebody argue that that's the laws of nature that's working?
Okay, so let's take a concrete example. Let's
immune system, for example, someone's sick and their immune system reacts to the sickness.
Yeah.
they get well. Somebody would say that's a miracle, and then another person will say, no, that's just science. That's their body, nature working.
So what do you think? Is it a miracle, or is that just nature running its course?
I think that kind of situation would be nature running its course.
Okay. Let's say I'm running late for church today, and every traffic light I go past is a green light. Is that a miracle?
To you, yes.
To me?
Yeah.
Are miracles subjective? Can something be a miracle to one person but not to another person? Yes. Well, can you elaborate, but in the microphone?
I don't really have any. It's a bit of a shame that the microphone, that there was all that suspense, because I think it's just that some people have more disbelief than others, and so when something wonderful and amazing happens, they call it a coincidence or, you know, something unlikely, but they wouldn't call it a miracle. So a lack of faith, perhaps, has something to do with it.
Okay. All right. So, but in saying that, are you saying that there is no objective measure of whether something is genuinely a miracle? Like, is it really just in the eye of the beholder?
I think there has to be an objective measure. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to have this conversation. But true. I just don't know what
it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's dive in and see what we can come up with. The definition I'm going to put forward today actually is exactly what Mina and Marina just said. It's those two things. So it's an event that violates the laws of nature, and that violation occurs through the direct and purposive action of God. Okay, because you may find something that you think violates the laws of nature, but it may not have a purpose. Okay, it may, I don't know, you might go home today and just find an empty cup floating in the air above your dinner table. Is that a miracle? Is that a, you know, what's the idea? What's the purpose of it? Oh, okay, no, maybe it's not. Maybe the cup has iron filings in its ceramic matrix, and I don't know, there's, for some reason, some workman's got a big magnet above the roof or something. I don't know, I'm making stuff up now. Okay, we're going to have a look at those two things. Oh, with my new glasses, I'm going to have trouble reading this. That's going to be a problem. Anyway, let's have a go. Okay, so basically, let's look at the first phrase, that it violates the laws of nature. For the Christian, we would say that everything is a miracle. If we're going to talk about something that happens without the laws of nature or different to the laws of nature, well, a universe that cannot create itself and yet exists is a miracle. It wasn't the laws of nature that created the universe. Think about it. The laws of nature are part of the universe. So how can something that's inside the universe cause the universe to exist in the first place? That doesn't make sense. So for the Christian, the whole universe is a miracle. Everything that happens in the universe is a miracle. Some of the commentators on the Gospels have said, for example, that when Jesus did the miracle of the five loaves, and he took five loaves and he broke and gave them out and 5,000 people ate, that really wasn't any greater a miracle than the miracle of a grain of wheat, you know, falling into the ground, growing into a plant that we can then take and make into bread. The fact that wheat grows into something that you can eat is in itself a miracle, in a way. The fact that we exist is a miracle. However, what we want to talk about today is not stuff like that. We want to talk about things that seem to be a special manifestation of something beyond nature breaking through into the universe. So it's something that starkly stands out, that it just doesn't fit within this universe. It doesn't fit with the laws of nature that we observe and experience and live within anyway. So one of the things we want to distinguish is what I'm going to call providence. Okay. Now, I would put the traffic light example and the immune system example that we had a little bit earlier, I would put them under the heading of providence. So providence is when you feel God has kind of intervened in some way and arranged things so that things work out better for you because he loves you. So on when 9/11 happened, you know, the aeroplanes crashing into the two office blocks, there were lots of stories of people who, you know, forgot their briefcase at home and had to go back and get it. Because of that, they were late for work, and because of that, they weren't in the building when the planes hit. Those sort of things. Would we call that a miracle? Not according to the definition that we're using here, because that doesn't violate the laws of nature. Okay? Forgetting your briefcase at home is something that happens to people all the time. But it may still be a purposive act of God. It may be that God somehow arranged the universe so that you would forget your briefcase on the day that the aeroplanes hit the office block where you work. And therefore, we still feel the love of God through that. We're going to call that providence. It's God providing for us. Can you use providence to convince someone who doesn't believe in God that God exists and is doing miracles? No, it's not going to work, is it? Because they're going to say exactly what I just said. People leave their briefcases behind all the time. We think it odd because, well, by probability, often we think, you know, how often does that happen? Yeah, how often do I get green lights all the way to church? I can tell you now, on 22 years of experience driving from home to church, the total numbers I've had all green lights all the way to church is zero. Okay, there's an awful lot of traffic lights between my home and church, though. So if it were ever to happen, that would be a highly unusual and unexpected event for me. It's a once in a 22-year, you know, event, at least. Who knows when it's going to happen? It might be one in 50 years by the time it happens. And if it were to happen on the day that it was most important of all the days I've come to church, if it were to happen to me on the day that it was most important for me to be on time at church, say the Pope was visiting the church or something like that, and I was running late, okay, then you would have to think about it and say, ooh, you know, that's statistically highly unlikely that the one day I get green lights is the one day I had to be on time. You know, that would make you sort of think. If it just happened someday when I was just, you know, coming for something that I do every week, then maybe you sort of think, oh, no, that's not really providential unless, you know, God wanted to sort of give me a little love card, you know, and say, you know, just want to remind you that I love you today. And I don't think I'd be wrong, you know, I don't think we are wrong in thinking that. When nice things happen to us, I think they are, in a way, a kind of expression of God's love for us. But try to tell that to a non-Christian and they'll probably, you know, laugh at you, basically. Okay, so we're not really going to be talking about providence today. We're talking about clear violations of the laws of nature, something that clearly is impossible. It could not happen if the laws of nature were to be obeyed. Okay, what about direct and purposive action of God? Okay, sometimes the laws of nature do appear to be broken. So one example is something called superconductivity. If you cast your minds back to your high school science, you remember that electricity flows through a metal by electrons, you know, running through it, and there's always something impeding the electrons, resistance. What was it? Ohm's law, wasn't it? Who remembers Ohm's law? What was it? Come on, you scientists who are here. Current over resistance equals something. Oh, come on, nobody remembers? How embarrassing. Nobody was paying attention in school science, obviously. Anyway, okay, so there's always a resistance. The interesting thing is, if you take some substances and cool them really, really, really cold, like close to absolute zero, you pass a point at which suddenly all the resistance disappears. It just totally disappears. The electrons just whiz through with no resistance whatsoever. That seems to break the laws of nature because any substance should offer resistance to a current going through it. This appears to be a miracle. And in fact, it took 50 years from the discovery of the phenomenon of superconductivity until someone was actually able to come up with a theory to explain why it happens. It took 50 years. So is superconductivity a miracle? It violates the laws of nature. Does it? Actually, no, it doesn't. What it actually shows is that we were ignorant of some of the laws of nature. According to the laws of nature that we knew, it seemed to violate them. But the discovery of superconductivity made us go back and think the whole thing through again and come up with new laws of nature to accommodate the phenomenon of superconductivity. And also, what purpose was there to a miracle like that? Imagine if that's the miracle that God decided to do in the world, to suddenly make resistance stop at low temperatures. What does that achieve? It doesn't seem to have a purpose to it. So it really doesn't qualify as a miracle under our definition. So when we speak of a miracle tonight, a genuine miracle will be something that actually has a purpose as well. It's not just, you know, for show. Before we go on to looking at it, it is important, since we're talking about the violation of the laws of nature, it's important to just stop for a minute and understand the nature of the laws of nature, if you'll pardon the pun. Okay. We sometimes think, especially because we use words like law, that it is something that is binding and cannot be broken. And this, in fact, is wrong. The example of superconductivity that we just saw is a really good example of why laws of nature are not binding laws that can never be broken. They are not like the laws of, you know, Darius, the king of the Medes, that can never be broken. Okay, they can be broken because we don't really understand nature properly yet or fully yet. A law of nature is really something that exists in our heads. It's not actually something that's out there in the world. What's out there in the world, and some of you may disagree with this, and you're welcome to disagree if you like, but what's actually real and exists out there in the world are things and events. A law of nature is when we see a pattern in those things and events, and so in our minds we kind of join the dots. Hence the diagram, okay? So the top graph is what actually exists out there in the real world. They're the dots, the data points. The line that joins them is really in our minds. And it's useful because when we make that line, we can therefore predict that there will be other dots along that line in the gaps between the dots that we first saw. And often that turns out to be true, which makes us more confident about a law. The important point that I'm trying to make here is you may get dots that don't fit on that graph. So the law is broken, like the superconductivity issue. So we just need to keep that in mind, that a violation of the laws of nature is allowed. We are allowed to do that. So there is always the chance, and this is often one of the things that's raised against miracles, that any alleged miracle, if we can't explain it with our current knowledge, that doesn't mean that it really violates the laws of nature, but all that it means is that we just haven't found the law, the relevant law of nature that we need to explain it. But by the end of tonight, I hope we'll have seen at least one example where even that really isn't going to stand up. Okay. One of the objections raised to miracles is, doesn't that mean that God is breaking his own laws? What kind of God would make a universe and put all these laws to govern it and then have to come back and fiddle with it and say, oh, you know, maybe this would be better if I did it this way and this would be better if I did it that way? Doesn't that make God to be less than all-knowing and all-powerful? So there are some responses that we can say to this. Oh, I like that. Do miracles make God out to be a celestial conjurer? Is he just a magician playing around, you know, rigging the game? Are miracles an arbitrary, clumsy, theatrical device only fit to impress the savages? I didn't write that. I forgot who did, but somebody wrote that. Somebody else apart from me. Okay. What the Christian can say in response to that is this. The laws of nature in the universe are not all the laws that there are. Because we believe that there exists more than the universe, there is something outside the universe, there is God, there is a transcendental world of the spirit outside of the universe, then there must also be laws that govern that world or that existence outside of the universe. And if God is to be consistent with himself, he won't only stick to the particular laws within the universe, but he will follow the complete set of laws both inside and outside of the universe. What happens is, because we are stuck inside the universe, we may see the laws inside the universe being violated. Okay. Jesus heals a man who's born blind. According to the laws of inside the universe, you can't do that. But there is every possibility that there are other laws outside of the universe, supernatural laws, heavenly laws, if you like, which, when you put both together, allow God to do that without actually infringing on the total set of the laws. Does that make sense, or have I confused you there? Yeah, so if we use the superconductivity, actually, that's kind of a parallel to it. So we only knew Ohm's law of resistance, okay? But there was another law that governs resistance at low temperatures that we didn't know. And that other law allowed the lack of resistance at very low temperatures. In the same sense, we only know laws that blind people born blind can't suddenly see within this universe. But there's another law, like the law of superconductivity, that we don't know, that might even be outside of this universe altogether, that allows a man born blind to be healed by the Son of God, you know, in a miraculous sort of way. You have a question? Not necessarily, because remember I'm saying that there is a set of laws that is within the universe. Those you don't have to call miracles. As Christians, actually, I would call them miracles. And in fact, people like very eminent scientists like Paul Davies, who is probably an agnostic now, was an atheist at one stage, he also says, you know, why is the universe regular? Why does the universe have laws like this? It's sort of, if you think about it, there's no reason why the universe should be so well ordered. So to me, as a Christian, that is a miracle. But that's not the definition of miracle we're using here. The point I'm making is that for us tonight, a miracle is something that breaks those laws within the universe. Okay. Most things that happen don't break those laws. So according to our definition we're using, they're not going to be miracles. The fact that all of you are still sitting on the seats and haven't floated up into the air, okay, that's not a miracle. It's because there's something called the law of gravity, and all of you are obeying it. What wonderful obedient people you are. You're all obeying it perfectly. None of you is breaking it in the slightest part. Okay, that's not a miracle, according to our definition. Okay. Alrighty. Okay, this is a nice quote from C.S. Lewis. This is kind of speaking about this, you know, common things being miracles and so on. There is an activity of God displayed throughout creation, a wholesale activity, let us say, which men refuse to recognize. The miracles done by God incarnate, living as a man in Palestine, perform the very same things as this wholesale activity, but at a very different speed, and on a smaller scale. One of their chief purposes is that men, having seen a thing done on the large scale, that the power behind it is also personal, is indeed the very same person who lived among us 2,000 years ago. So the point he's making is that when Jesus broke the laws of nature, he was doing miracles, but really all he was doing is following those bigger laws of nature, which we see on the big scale of the universe. And if you can't tell that those are miracles, if you can't tell that Ohm's law is itself a miracle, that it exists, Jesus came to do little miracles to let us know that the same person who did those little miracles that we know are miracles is the same person who wrote Ohm's law, which is a big miracle. Okay. And here's another one, the greatest miracle. It is the claim of the New Testament that in Jesus, a totally new regime entered into the realm of human experience. If this is the case, then it is to be expected that it might be accompanied by a new phenomena. The test of credibility will lie in whether one can articulate a coherent understanding of the world in which such phenomena can find a fitting place. Some people would say, you know, how could Jesus come and do miracles? Well, what basically he's saying there is the question is, can we come up with a model for how the world works that allows God to be a human being and to do miracles? And the answer as a Christian, of course, we would say is yes, we have a very good model that explains how that happens. Okay. And once again, on the miracles of Christ and the purpose of miracles, the miracles of Christ, in fact, are a retelling in small letters of the very same story which is written across the whole world in letters too large for some of us to see. Once again, Jesus feeding the 5,000 from five loaves is really not that different to God feeding the 7 billion with some seeds every day. That happens every day and we don't think of it as a miracle, but in fact it is. Okay. Any questions before we go on to the next section? Okay, so the next question we're going to look at now is how are we going to evaluate an alleged miracle? Someone comes along to you and says, I've seen a miracle. How are you going to tell whether that really is a miracle or whether it isn't? I'm going to begin by pointing this out. I like this very simple quote. For those who believe in miracles, no explanation is necessary. For those who do not believe, no explanation is possible. Okay, basically, there are two extremes. There are those who will say that every alleged miracle must be a genuine miracle. It is a miracle. And if you dare say it's not a miracle, if you dare doubt or question it, well, I'm sorry, but you're going to hell because you're not a real Christian. That's an extreme position. At the other end is the person who says nothing can possibly be a miracle. So even if Jesus were to appear in front of that person, floating 3 feet in the air, lightning bolts coming out of his fingertips, and speak with a booming voice and say, do you believe in me now? He's going to say no, because, sorry, miracles don't happen. So there must be some other explanation for you. Okay, they're the two extreme positions. And what I would like to suggest to you tonight is neither of those is really tenable. Okay, neither of those is going to be something you can justify. If we are real Christians, and I'm going to use this phrase tonight, the sensible Christian. So the sensible Christian, the rational Christian, is the Christian who doesn't think like that extreme that I just described. Where, you know, how dare you even doubt that that's a miracle? Okay. We're going to see some interesting miracles soon where I have heard people in real life see, for example, you know, someone spread Vegemite on a piece of toast and then they looked at it and it was St. Mary in the Vegemite. Okay. And of course that goes viral all over the internet. And I've had people who say, you know, when I question that and say, I really don't think that's a miracle, they are shocked. Abuna, you're a priest. What are you saying? You really mean that's not a miracle? Okay. Sorry, I don't think it's a miracle. Okay. We care about truth. Christians don't just want their team to win at all costs. It's not like, you know, if anything even looks like a miracle, then I'm going to back it up because that's on my side. And therefore, it's got to be right. No. We are not Christians just because we want our team to win. We're Christians because we believe in truth and we look for truth and we even believe that our God is the God of truth. And when he was incarnate and became a man, he called himself the truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. So we actually have a responsibility as Christians to sift the wheat from the chaff. We have to separate what is really a miracle and what isn't really a miracle. And therefore, I think the sensible Christian is actually a skeptical Christian. And I'm kind of backed up by that because churches, by and large, are pretty skeptical about miracles. As far as I know, the Coptic Church has only made an official announcement that an event was a miracle maybe half a dozen times in the last 100 years. Okay, there are heaps of stories. We have heaps of books about Pope Carolus and his miracles. I think they're up to volume 27 or something by now. Okay, there are heaps of stories about Amba Brahm and his miracles and so on. But none of those have been officially sanctioned, officially declared by the church to be genuine miracles. There's only very, very few. And that tells me that the church is very, very cautious about what it actually declares to be a miracle. And there are good reasons. Let's have a look at some of the reasons why. Human beings are not the most accurate of witnesses. So we are liable to a lot of fallibility, a lot of ways of being mistaken. If you look at the top diagram there, which of the horizontal lines is longer? The top one or the bottom one? You've seen it before. Okay, the answer is they're exactly the same length. Can you see that? Have a look at them. Can you see them as being the same length? In fact, if you can, please forgive me for saying this, but you're lying. Because people have actually done studies on this and found that this is kind of one of those automatic programs in your brain, and you don't have conscious control over it. The illusion that's being triggered here is one that you cannot consciously reverse. The only way you can be sure that those two lines are the same length is to actually get a ruler and physically measure it, and then you'll know that they're exactly the same length. Okay, the two middle vertical lines in the bottom diagram, are they straight or curved? Once again, try and see them as straight. Try and force your mind to see them as straight. And once again, you won't be able to. Because again, they're some of the quirks of our visual processing system and how it works and so on. Okay, so that's just an example of how we can be fooled by the quirks of our hardware and software, if I can put it that way. Yeah. So are you saying they are the same or they're not the same? Okay. If I had a big ruler, I'd go up and get you to measure it. But just Google optical illusions when you go home. It comes up. It's one of the most popular ones. Okay, get your ruler and measure it and see if I'm lying. Okay, the human mind is also really, really good at seeing patterns in things where they may not actually exist. How many of you have lain in your backyard looking up at the sky and seeing bunny rabbits and dragons in the clouds? Okay, we do that really well. Okay, a computer would look at that and just see data points of greater or lesser light. Human beings looked at that and saw this. And then they turned it into this, okay? Or from just a few dots of light. So we see things, we read patterns into things. And once again, there are good reasons for that. That actually helps us to survive. It helps us to get along in our life. But it can also then be used to make us think that the laws of nature have been broken when they haven't really been broken. What do you think of this one? Is this a miracle? As far as I know, that is not photoshopped. I can't be 100% sure. But if you saw this in the sky tomorrow at lunchtime, would you say that's a miracle? What do you think? True. And if I tried to suggest to her that it wasn't, she'd probably get really upset with me, wouldn't she? Okay. I don't think that is a miracle. Actually, my guess is that they're the contrails of aeroplanes, probably. You know how aeroplanes leak fuel and stuff like that? And it just happened that the wind blew it in that sort of, you know, direction or whatever. It does look odd. Our minds immediately look at that and see the figure of Christ hanging on the cross. That's because our mind is programmed to read patterns into things, to interpret things, to make them meaningful for us. Is that the face of Jesus? People chopped down a tree, and guess who was waiting inside the trunk? Okay. Here's a better one. This is on the lid of a jar of Vegemite. They didn't even spread it out on the toast. Can you see the face of Jesus there? Okay. By the way, I don't think any of these are miracles. Okay. I'm giving you examples of why the sensible Christian has to be really, really skeptical. Okay, so I'm actually going to suggest to you, I reckon that the vast majority of alleged miracles are not genuine miracles. I don't think they are. But I do think that there is a minority which you cannot escape from, and they are really genuine miracles. We're going to see in a little while. Benny Hinn is one of my favourite TV evangelists. He's a real character, this fellow. I think he comes on the Christian channel every now and then, and other channels too, I believe. You can watch him. He's a real showman. Okay, he claims to have healed thousands of people by faith healing. He has this really cool worship thing where he'll line up like 30 people all standing in a line, and he'll stand and pray and pray and pray with a rising voice for them, and then suddenly he'll go up to them and go whoosh with his hand like that, and all 30 of them fall to the ground as if they've been blown over by a tornado or something. Is that a miracle? Okay, there was an NBC report apparently done in 2005 where they kind of went backstage and talked confidentially to some of the people who work with him and stuff like that. And guess what they found? All sorts of tricks and illusions and, you know, all sorts of stuff he was doing. So, for example, the healings that he claimed to do, they actually have people standing in the audience, and if you have an illness and you want to be healed, you have to come up to the person, and they choose who gets to go up to be healed by him. And what they found is that, whether consciously or unconsciously, they were choosing only people who had diseases that can be caused psychosomatically, like diseases that can, you know, like when you get really anxious and then you think you have bowel problems or something like that. You get tummy pains. Okay. And he has a wonderful success rate. He healed lots of them. But where were the ones, you know, who were genuinely physically sick? They often didn't make it through the filter. An example of some of the things. So this is human suggestibility. And those guys falling over, by the way, I'm convinced that's a kind of hypnotism. I don't even think it's demonic or anything like that. I don't think the devil would waste his time, to be honest. Okay. And there are people who are not even Christian or anything who do exactly the same stuff, not by the power of the Holy Spirit or by demons or anything, but because they use the way that our brains work. They use the human susceptibility to having a suggestion planted into your brain and then acting out on that suggestion. It makes for a really good show. Okay, when we've eliminated, and I've just given you a few examples of the kinds of things which I don't think are miracles. When we've eliminated all of those, we're still left with this little group of events that seem to be unexplainable or inexplicable. I don't know if they both work. Anyway, that still seem to be violating the laws of nature with a purpose. What are we going to say about those things? And I'm going to suggest to you that, as we were kind of saying at the very beginning, I think the person's answer to whether those events are genuine miracles or not doesn't depend, for most people, on the evidence. It depends, for most people, on what they think about the world. So if you have a naturalistic worldview, by which I mean a person who believes only physical laws of nature are real, there is no God, there is nothing, there is no spirit, there is no Holy Spirit, there's nothing like that. If you are convinced about that from the beginning, then as we read a little bit earlier, no amount of evidence is ever going to be sufficient for you. Whereas if you are, like most of us, we leave the possibility open I believe that the Christian is in a better position to be objective about it, because we kind of have nothing to lose. If it doesn't turn out to be a miracle, we haven't lost anything. Our Christian faith would be exactly the same if no miracles ever happened, except for one. There's just one miracle that is essential to the Christian faith. You know what that is, don't you? The resurrection, of course, yeah. Okay, apart from that, yeah, the miracles that Christ did showed his divinity, and that was really nice, but even if he hadn't done those, but he had still died on the cross and risen from the dead, our Christianity would be pretty much exactly the same. So whether we find miracles or we don't find miracles, we have nothing to lose. We can be objective. For the naturalistic person, for the skeptic, the atheist, they have a lot invested, because although a million false miracles won't change anything, all it will take is just one genuine miracle, and they have to toss out their whole worldview. They have to throw it out. The very foundation of their life, their belief that God doesn't exist, or at least that something beyond this world doesn't exist, is totally demolished. So they kind of have a vested interest in not being objective in looking for the truth. Okay, ever heard of a guy called Chris Angel? Okay, yeah, I've seen a few of his shows on TV. Here he is floating in the air on television. Now, is there anybody here who thinks that is a genuine miracle? That the laws of nature have been violated by the showman who makes millions of dollars from his show, I'm sure, Chris Angel, in spite of his lovely name? Demonic. Yeah. Do you think the magician, at the local open day at school, who cuts a woman in half, and you can see her feet jiggling in one half of the box and her hand waving from the other half of the box, is that demonic, do you think? Okay, I've never seen it. You have to tell me afterwards. Do they have a midget in the little box? Okay, so they haven't really broken, if there's an explanation for it, they haven't really broken the laws of nature. People like Chris Angel, although they never come out on TV and publicly say it, because that would be pretty bad for business, they actually, in private, they don't claim to have any supernatural powers. They're just really, really good magicians. And they spend years coming up with ways of doing these tricks. And we know that because they explain some of their simpler ones. And, and you think about it and say, wow, once you get to know the trick, it's so obvious. How come I couldn't see that before? But until you know that trick, it seems to be like a miracle. Okay. Why I've got Chris Angel up there is I'm going to suggest to you that the atheist or the naturalist is a bit like someone watching Chris Angel. They know in their minds that it cannot be a miracle. Okay, I'm a bit like that when I watch Chris Angel. I know in my mind that he's not breaking the laws of nature because of all the explanations that he and people like him have given for other tricks. So I'm convinced of that. So no matter how stunning the trick is, no matter how incredibly obvious the evidence is that the laws of nature have been broken, I'm still not going to believe it. Yeah? This is what the atheist does or the skeptic does about miracles in the real world. But the question we have to ask is this: does the skeptic in the real world have as good a reason for being so convinced that the laws of nature can't be broken as I have when I'm watching Chris Angel? My evidence is that the magicians themselves confess and say, we are not breaking the laws of nature. And if you don't believe me, here's a few examples of how I didn't break the laws of nature. I was just tricking you. Okay, that's a pretty good reason. Has God come down to us and said, oh, and by the way, everyone, if you ever think that anything is a miracle, it really isn't, because I'm not breaking the laws of nature. Has that happened? It hasn't happened. What reason do we have to think that? In fact, I can't think of any reason why we should think that miracles, why we should be as confident that miracles could not happen. And that's the question that the skeptic has to answer. Why are you so certain? How can you be so certain? Here's a hypothetical. This is our friend Richard Dawkins. What would it take to convince Richard Dawkins that a miracle has happened? Okay, I've come up with something. I'll go ahead, but can we sort of get the microphone moving? No, I just need someone to maybe wander around and pass it down so everyone can hear. What would it take to convince Richard Dawkins?
Are there any boundaries to what we can say for this answer?
No. Let your imagination run free.
So one argument which I wanted to ask later was that a lot of people say that if a miracle happens in front of me where an amputee suddenly grows a leg or grows an arm, then they would be convinced that that's a miracle.
Okay. Can I be Richard Dawkins here for a minute? He's one of my favourite people in the world. Okay. No. Sorry? Yeah. Maybe there's a law of biology. I've seen, what are they called? The things that you chop off?
Salamanders.
Salamanders, yes. I've seen salamanders have a leg, a whole leg chopped off and grow a new leg. And there's a lot of overlap in the DNA between salamanders and human beings. So why couldn't this just be some freak mutation totally within the laws of nature that made the leg grow back? You haven't convinced me. Sorry. Try again.
If a man grows a baby in his stomach, for example.
I've seen that in the movies.
In the movies, but not in real life.
Well, wasn't it Arnold Schwarzenegger or something that had a baby? Okay. Why not? All you need to do is go and have secret surgery, have a womb implanted and have hormone injections.
Without any intervention.
How do I know that there's no intervention? I didn't live with the man all of his life. Someone's tricking us.
Put him under observation.
Okay, so I have to observe him from the beginning of his life when he's born. I don't have time for that.
I think.
Try something else.
What would take turning Richard Dawkins to believing in miracles or magic or any supernatural is somebody swinging a wand and he turns into a cockroach or something like that, like completely different to being human.
I've seen caterpillars turn into butterflies. That's perfectly natural. That's not a miracle. Yeah, one more. Yeah, but can you just grab the microphone, Mina, and pass it back? Just switch it on.
I was going to say, I don't think he will, because if he doesn't want to see it, he won't see it.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. That's really the conclusion that I was trying to illustrate. In fact, I think if Jesus himself appeared to Richard Dawkins, he would probably say, oh, I really shouldn't have had that, second helping at dinner because my indigestion is giving me hallucinations and this is a bad dream or something, and that's all that it is. I'll have some antacid tomorrow so I don't see Jesus.
Yeah, I actually saw him in a debate say exactly the same thing. If Christ appeared to you in the bedroom and he's like, oh, yeah, no, I would have been having some sort of hallucination or I drank too much or something. And that wouldn't convince me one bit. And so,
yeah. Okay. Now, why is he saying this? Why is he like this? I find it a very frustrating situation. You can actually trace a lot of this back to an 18th century philosopher from Scotland called David Hume, who was a brilliant man, and he wrote an essay or part of a book called Of Miracles, in which he suggested that he has demolished the possibility of miracles. And many atheists or skeptics today base their resistance, like Richard Dawkins' argument about hallucination and so on, really base it on the thinking of David Hume. So we're just going to spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes to quickly run through it because it is the foundation of a lot of the challenges. Okay, he breaks it up into two parts. He says for any alleged miracle, we have to do two things. We have to first assess the reliability of the witness, the person who claims to have experienced the miracle. And second, we have to assess the likelihood of the event itself. Is it something that is probable, common, or is it very rare and unlikely? So let's have a look at those two. Okay, so this is someone else, Thomas Paine, one of the founding fathers of America, who was following his thinking, and he put it in a nice, simple way. Is it more probable that nature should go out of her course, or that a man should tell a lie? Which one is more likely? So if someone comes and says to you, I've seen an amputated limb grow back. Is it more likely that that really happened, or is it more likely that the person who's speaking to you is lying to you? You can guess where he's going with this, can't you? Okay, so he completes it and says, we have never seen in our time nature go out of her course, but we have good reason to believe that millions of lies have been told in the same time. It is therefore at least millions to one that the reporter of a miracle tells a lie. That sounds like a very strong argument, doesn't it? Would you agree? And we've kind of been saying the same thing, because I've been suggesting to you that the sensible Christian begins by being skeptical. We don't begin by believing every account of a miracle. Okay, he then elaborates a little bit more. He says, okay, let's have a look at why we doubt the witnesses. Number one, you have to question the education, the character, the competence of the witnesses. So if the witness is generally ignorant and gullible, then their testimony is of far less value than that of someone who is generally intelligent and skeptical. He, by the way, he was mostly interested in demolishing the miracles of Christ. And his argument, why he's saying these kinds of things, is he's saying, like, the disciples are the main witnesses who've given a, you know, report of the miracles of Christ, and they were, you know, uneducated fishermen, gullible, you know, Matthew was a tax collector, everybody knows tax collectors were cheats and liars and stuff like that. So he's sort of saying it's much more likely, you know, that they would be lying, that the apostles were lying. We're going to point this out, though, that it is true that we're susceptible to getting things wrong, as we looked at many of the examples a little bit earlier. However, we have to beware of the logical fallacy of saying that something cannot be true because I don't trust the person who told it to me. Okay, now just think about this. If someone lies to me about heaps of things, and then they come to me one day and they say to me, oh, a bomb went off at the Boston Marathon 3 days ago. Am I going to be justified in saying, because this guy lied to me so many times before, he must be lying about the bomb going off at the Boston Marathon? Would I be justified in saying that? I would be justified. Okay, I don't mean justified as in would I be, you know, making sense if I said that. Yes, I'm making sense. Would I be right, maybe is how I should have put it. The answer is no, I would be wrong because the bomb did go off at the Boston Marathon 3. So just because someone untrustworthy tells you something doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't happen. You can't say that. You can't be confident about that. It may make it less likely that it's true, but it can never totally cancel it out. Okay, second, he says that human beings love the unusual. You know, we love a wonder. We love something strange. That's why we go to circuses and see, you know, the hairy woman and the man with four arms and the elephant man and stuff like that. Okay. So he says because people love the unusual, then if they hear something, then they're more likely to think it's a miracle than to think of a natural explanation for it, because that's much more exciting. And people will do that. However, they have to balance that against the human love for truth. If we weren't wired to look for truth, we couldn't survive in this world. You know, if I wanted my phone to be working even when it wasn't working and deluded myself that it was working because I really, really wanted to be working, and then, you know, I need to ring 000, my delusion is not going to help me. I'm going to probably die because it's not working. So we also are wired to look for truth. And again, a motivation doesn't mean that what I said was wrong. Scientists love for their work to be right, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always right. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's always wrong, I mean. Okay, thirdly, he says that you have to look at the historical and social conditions that affect people's gullibility. So he makes this funny claim that miracle accounts are far more common in backward societies than they are in more advanced societies. Okay, number one, this is again this genetic fallacy. Okay, just because someone is backward doesn't mean that they didn't genuinely see a miracle and relate it accurately. You can't just say that out of hand. Number two, is it really true that miracle accounts are more common in backward societies? I think one of the most sort of supernatural societies in the world is actually the most civilized society in the world. Where do you get the highest concentration of UFO sightings? Where do you get the highest concentration of alien abductions? Where do you get the highest concentration of miracle cures that you can buy for $3.99 plus postage and handling? Okay, which country has the biggest industry going on in these weird paranormal areas? Okay, it's not Bangladesh. It's not, you know, the Congo Republic. It's the USA. It's America, which is the most civilized society in the world. So I'm not quite sure that you can really make that argument. And even if it was true, even if that pattern was real, just because two factors occur together, that doesn't necessarily mean that one of them caused the other. You can't immediately say that because people are backward, then they think that miracles happen. When people are civilized, they no longer think that miracles happen. The two may be caused by something totally different by itself. It might be materialism. Okay. The most advanced, the richest. Okay, yes, we won't go into that discussion. He was just questioning if America was really the most civilized society. And I have to say, with all their arguments about having guns and how so many guns in the country, that is a very good question, yes. We have to question how civilized they are. Okay, so there may be other reasons. Okay, and finally his claim is, okay, Christians say that miracles happen due to their God. Muslims say that miracles happen due to their God. Hindus say that miracles happen due to their gods. Well, they can't all be real gods, so therefore they have to all be wrong. Since they conflict, then they must all be wrong. Is that a sensible argument? I'm going to suggest to you that it isn't, because there is another alternative, which is that one of them is right and all the others are wrong. And that's a very valid alternative. So, for example, people are trying to come up with a theory of everything, you know, that unites quantum mechanics with general relativity and special relativity and stuff. Nobody's managed to do it yet. Whoever does will be bigger than Einstein. There are a number of alternative theories, string theory, M theory, loop quantum gravity, a few others that are a bit more esoteric. None of them can live with the others. If you believe in quantum loop theory, you cannot believe in string theory. They don't work together. So if we're going to use the same reasoning, then we're going to have to say, therefore, all of them are wrong. None of those theories are correct. But that's not what scientists think, and they're quite justified in not thinking that way. There is a good chance that one of those will turn out to be right. And in the same way, we can't say that just because all religions claim miracles, therefore all religions are false and their miracles are false. If there is a true religion, then it's going to be the true one and the others are the imitations, basically, for whatever reason, suggestibility, demonic action, whatever it might be. So when we break Hume's challenge down to those four points that he makes, we find that actually none of them are very compelling, none of them are very strong. Here is a quote from him. No testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle. Does that sound like Richard Dawkins? No testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle. Unless, okay, he's going to be generous now, unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. So in other words, if you're going to make me believe in a miracle, then you're going to have to make me believe that if the person who's telling me about the miracle is lying, that would be a more astonishing miracle than if they were telling the truth and the miracle really happened. And I think we've got an example coming up. We're going to see it in the second section. Okay, this brings up the issue of probability and how it relates to miracles. Imagine if you have a coin and you toss the coin 10 times and it comes down heads every single one of the 10 times. I'm now going to ask you to toss it the 11th time. What's going to happen the 11th time? What are your chances of getting a head? Hmm? 10 to 1, you're saying? Okay, if you ask a mathematician, you know what they're going to tell you, don't they? Don't you? It's 50-50. Okay, why? Okay, assuming that the coin isn't rigged, okay, and although that is something we have to take into account, it could be rigged, but assuming that it's not rigged, and I actually sat down and worked this out on my calculator, the chances of getting 10 heads in a row is a mere 1 in 1,024. So if you have 1,024 people each tossing a coin 10 times, one of those 1,024 people is going to get 10 heads in a row. That's just by sheer chance. Okay. So when Hume is saying to us that, oh, you know, you have to show me that miracles are likely, that miracles are probable, we have to say to him, well, number one, the improbable still happens. Okay, so you can't just sort of dismiss it out of hand. And, okay, we'll come back to that in a second. I want to show you this. This is from a novel called Contact by Carl Sagan, which has also been made into a movie. Carl Sagan's an atheist. He's dead now. He was an atheist. And he actually, though, in this novel, has his heroine meet some aliens, and the aliens give her a hint that somewhere in the universe there is a hidden message. And he gives her the hint that it's in the value of pi, pi being the ratio of the diameter to the circumference of a circle, 3.141159. Actually, if you want to know what it is, it's 3.141592653589793. Okay, we'll stop there. Okay, so she goes home. She makes this computer program which prints out the decimals, the digits of pi, and she attaches it to another program that looks for patterns. Now, can you see any patterns in that block of numbers there? Can anyone see it? And if you've read the book or seen the movie, please don't call out. Anyone see it? It's really hard to see it. Okay, shall I make it a little bit more obvious for you? Ready? I've highlighted the zeros in red. Ooh. What would you say if you printed out the digits of pi and found that all the zeros make a circle when pi is the ratio of the diameter to the circumference of, you guessed it, a circle? What are the odds? Would we say that that's a miracle? I need to warn you, by the way, that I have actually fiddled the digits. I actually did change digits into zeros. That doesn't really happen. Okay, so don't go home and try and do it for yourself, because you'll be very disappointed. Okay, would that be? Okay, I don't think that would qualify as a miracle, because it doesn't violate the laws of nature. But it is a highly, highly, highly improbable event. And I think we would be justified in saying that it is so improbable that if you had, you know, a billion universes with different values of pi, you wouldn't find this, you know, except in maybe, I don't know, one, you could work out the maths of it. Actually, it's kind of one in infinity, because the digits of pi are thought to be infinite anyway. Okay, so you would have to say this is so incredibly weird that this must be, you know, a calling card from God. 2 years ago, one of our first meetings actually was presented by Abram, where we looked at the design argument for the existence of God. And Abram gave us all these figures of probabilities of constants. And when you sort of work out the probability of all of them coinciding, it was some, wasn't it some huge number that you couldn't fit in the universe or something like that?
There was one number, it was 1 over 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123 or something like that, which is, and there's only 1 to the, sorry, there's only 10 times 120, 10 times 120 molecules in the universe, so it was like a million billion billion times more than the molecules of the universe, that there's just one parameter, that the heat of the universe would be what it is. So, yeah and then that's one parameter out of 30, so, yeah.
I think we would be justified, faced with those sort of figures, in saying even though it is not completely impossible, it is so unlikely that we are justified in saying that it is pretty much, for all practical purposes, impossible. And miracles, by definition, are rare events. If they were common, they wouldn't be miracles. They'd be part of the laws of nature because they would be happening every day. So by definition, a miracle is a rare event. And so it turns out that Hume's argument about the event and how likely it is, number one, you can't say that miracles are rare, therefore they don't happen, because that's kind of a circular argument. Because they're rare, they don't happen. Because they don't happen, they're rare. And because they're rare, they don't happen. And because they don't happen, they're rare. You're just going around in a circle. Okay, it's you're not really showing anything. Okay, let's just whiz through. So the key issue for Hume's critique of miracles is whether or not we ever have reason to believe on the basis of testimony that a law of nature has been violated. Hume's arguments lead to the conclusion that we never have reason to believe miracle reports as passed on to us. So it's important to note that he's not really making an argument that miracles don't happen. What he's making an argument for is that if someone tells you they witnessed or experienced a miracle, then you shouldn't believe them. That doesn't answer, it doesn't even touch the question of what if you directly experience a miracle. So this is, I used Hume as an example because, as I said, he's basically the foundation of most modern thinking against miracles. And he turns out to be a really dodgy foundation. There's a lot of people who are not even Christians and don't even believe in God who agree with that analysis of Hume's argument, that it is a really dodgy argument. Okay, if there are questions or discussion points, we can do that for maybe 10 minutes and then we'll have a break, and then we'll come back and see the big miracle that I've been talking about, which I think even Hume couldn't argue with. But we'll see. Any questions or discussions yet? But please use the microphone when you do.
I've just got a comment. Just with that philosopher David Hume, I think it's actually been fairly unanimously recognized now that his argument is actually mathematically false, that people have published books about it. They're just, because the probability calculus wasn't even developed in his time. I think it was developed a century or two after him. And using the probability calculus, working out, he only took into account one factor, the intrinsic probability of something. So when you work it into the actual equation, it's actually just straight out false. So whoever makes that argument to you is just reiterating a mathematical fallacy. So I think there was a book by a philosopher called Hume's Abject Failure. Yeah. And if you look that up, you'll find out, like, it's by a philosopher of, I think, philosopher of mathematics, and he did it as well. So
John Ehrman, I think.
Yeah, John Ehrman, yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you for being kind to Hume. You know, maybe it wasn't his fault. He didn't know, you know, the knowledge wasn't around when he made his argument. So that's very Christian of you, Abram. Thank you. And any other questions or thoughts? No further discussion at this stage? Okay, that was the heavy part of the night. I apologize for that. The next part is going to be more interesting, where we actually look at the evidence and we suss it out. Just before we break, can I just ask once again, because I asked earlier when there were much fewer people here, is there anyone here, and we're not going to force you to the front or anything, we may politely ask you, and if you decline, we'll let it go, but is there anyone here who has themselves personally experienced or witnessed a miracle? And if you're too shy to raise your hand, just come and tell me after. Okay, so it doesn't look like anyone has raised their hand. I don't know if that means none of you have or if that means that you're just shy about saying it. But anyway. Okay, don't tell us now. We'll keep it for the second half. Alrighty. So we'll have a break and we'll try and come back about 5 to 8 to continue with our discussion. There are nibblies and snacks outside on the table if you would like to refresh yourself. Okay, if you'd like to take a seat. And we'll make a start. Okay, so what we're going to do in this last hour is I'm going to present 3 cases to you of alleged miracles. And they're presented for your analysis and discussion. So I'm just going to present the case and then please join in the discussion, so we can hopefully apply some of the principles that we saw a little bit earlier to them. So here is the first of the three cases. This is the case of the man with the oily hands. This is not, I just got this picture off the internet. But what it is when I was ordained as a priest, as a new priest, and you know the new priests spend 40 days in the monastery in seclusion. So way back then we used to go to the monastery of Saint Bishoy in the desert of Egypt. And we were there, not very far from where Pope Shenouda had his cell when he would go for a retreat in the monastery. So we got to see a lot of really interesting stuff, people who came to see the Pope about all sorts of things. One of them was a man from some Middle Eastern country, I don't remember what, Jordan, Syria, somewhere like that, who came to show the Pope the miracle of his hands. And the Pope, he spoke to the Pope for about 5 minutes. The Pope didn't look terribly impressed, and he was very busy, so he found these newly ordained priests standing around with nothing to do. So he said to us, there were four of us at the time, plus a monk who's now Amba Angelos in England, he said to the five of us, take him up to the church, pray a tamgid, some hymns of praise, and later on I'll ask you what you saw. So we did. We went up and we started praying the tamgid and everything, and the man is standing there praying really fervently. And then suddenly, halfway through the tamgid, he suddenly started walking around to all of us, holding his hands out like this and saying, look, look, see, didn't I tell you? Have a look, see, see, see. And so we all had a good look. Sure enough, there was oil coming out of his hands, coming out of the palm of his hands. And I actually, very impolitely, rolled up his sleeve, you know, make sure there's no little wicks or tubes or something there. I had a look on the front and on the back, wiped the oil off with a handkerchief, yeah, and it seeped out, you know, more oil seeped out, and it was coming out. What do you think? Was this a miracle? So please use the microphones as you give us your opinions. I can see a few heads shaking there. Avram shaking his head with a very wry smile on his lips. Do you want to grab the microphone and tell us why you look so cynical?
I was laughing at something. One of these two people said something. They said naturally increased sebaceous gland secretion or something.
Okay, so you think it's sebaceous glands are secreting lots of stuff? Microphone.
I just thought, like, the first thing when I saw that picture, I thought, well, it could be just a genetic thing where he has more glands in his, like, in his hands, and he's just producing a lot more oil. So,
anybody care to disagree with that? Does that happen? Can it happen that people can just... why does it happen when someone sings praises to God? Wouldn't that make you doubtful about your theory? Doesn't that seem to be a bit coincidental? Okay, sorry. Microphone though, please. So can we get that microphone down here and, like, sort of, you know, have a dynamic microphone thing happening?
Okay. It's oil coming out of the hands. It's obviously a miracle. That doesn't happen. And they can, and it's like a fountain in a way, right?
It wasn't a fountain, no, it seeped out.
Yeah.
So it didn't spurt out or anything like that. It was just seeping out.
Yeah.
So you know when you have a wet sponge that kind of looks dry, but then when you squeeze it, the water kind of seeps out onto the surface? That's pretty much what it was. It was at a very, very slow rate. That's what it looked like. So, yeah, we have two responses here. We'll go to Ragati, then Michael.
Okay. You do know, like, when people say give speeches or they're really nervous, their palms become really sweaty. And also, like, in, I'll say, use Pentecostal churches where they have that sort of psychosomatic response to praise and worship. It could be a similar thing where that man, when he prays, he feels a sort of a stimuli, and that sets him off to sweat a lot in his hands and produce that oil. So that's just a scientific
Okay. Building a pretty strong case here. Michael? Will the microphone reach?
I just wanted to say that I think the context seems a bit strange, like the fact that the man is boasting. Why would you boast? Miracles don't really go out in that way. The other thing is, what's the objective? Like, if it was a miracle, why? What do you benefit when you have oily hands? What are people going to think and what are they going to achieve? I'm not really supporting or explaining how, but I just that's where I'd approach.
Yeah. But you make some very good points, because if miracles are performed through the power of God, you would expect them to be in keeping with the principles of God, which include humility and things like that. So yes, for a person to be boasting, look at me, didn't I tell you, look at me, I do miracles, that does cast a lot of doubt. What does anyone think of the possibility of demonic action? We know that demons can do, wonders. Are you just nodding or do you want to say something?
I just think the fact that he was distracting you from...
Sorry, can we get the microphone though? So, because people won't hear you.
Like, sometimes the devil does do tricks and things like that, and he knows humanity, so he knows what we would believe and what would make us think things and what would steer us off the wrong track. And the fact that he was distracting you from praising God during your tisbaha, that's like a pretty bad sign. Like that, I don't think that would be from God, but that's my opinion.
Yeah, so it doesn't really fit in the bigger framework of how we understand God to operate, really, does it? So, okay, so here we have a situation where we've got three possible theories. We've got one, it is a genuine miracle performed by God. Two, there's a perfectly natural medical explanation for it, psychosomatic stimulus, making the sebaceous glands secrete, hypersecretion sort of thing, extra secretion. And number three, it might be a violation of the laws of nature, but not due to the action of God, but due to the action of the dark side, the demons. So overall, should we give this miracle a tick or a cross as a miracle, do you think? Well, here's my one. Oh, sorry, what happened there? Oh, there it is. Oh, sorry, there's an explanation of it. Yes, I'm going to give it a cross. Would you like to know what the Pope thought? Because afterwards, the next day, we went and said to him, Sedna, would you like to know what happened? He said, yeah, tell me what happened. We described it. And then he said to us, what do you think? And to be honest, we were all a little bit skeptical, mostly for the kinds of reasons that you've been saying. And then we asked him, and what do you think, Your Holiness? And he just laughed. And he didn't look very impressed by the whole thing, So he didn't actually say anything, but he just gave a very strong indication that he really didn't think it was a miracle. Or if it was, then, it's certainly not something for us that we need to take notice of. It's not that important. Okay, that was a pretty easy one. This one's a little bit harder. The case of the little saint. Anybody here pray at St. Abinoob's Church? Oh, sorry, is that a question? Sorry, just sit in the microphone.
Sorry, I just wanted to know about the one before. Did that man think it was a miracle?
The guy whose hands had the oil. Yeah, he was convinced it was a miracle. Absolutely, yeah. That's why he wanted to, impress the Pope. Like, I'm a holy man, You should take notice of me. Yeah. Okay, how many people here pray at St. Abinoob Church? Anyone? Just a quick show of the hands. Occasionally, here and there. Okay. Then you will recognize this saint. Now, this is a picture that someone sent me in an email 7-8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. I can't remember exactly. So this is a picture of the front of St. Abinoob's Church in Blacktown. And I don't know if you can see it there, but there's like a little boy standing in front of the curtain. And he's not dressed in modern clothes. He's dressed like a little peasant boy from Egypt. Okay, I think I've enlarged it. Yes. Did I do more? Oh, sorry, I showed you what I've... Oh, dear. Dear, oh, dear. That was a mistake. Pretend you didn't see that. Okay. What do you think of this? Is this a miracle? So can you see there's a head, there's a face, there's a body, the arms are crossed. Oddly enough, there seem to be no feet. There's a gap between the bottom of the galabeya and the floor. Okay, and apparently the story that came with this email is that someone was just taking a picture of the front of the church, and when they, I think this was back in the days before digital cameras, when they processed it, I can't remember actually, maybe it wasn't. But anyway, when they looked at it, they saw this little boy who they hadn't seen, you know, when they were just standing there taking the picture. He only turned up in the picture, which kind of fits with the framework of what we know about little Saint Abinoub, because there's an awful lot of stories about him being a bit cheeky. He's not like your average respectable, sensible saint who just comes and, you know, very respectfully does a miracle and then goes away. Saint Abinoub has been known to tease other naughty children and things like that, you know, jump in where he's not supposed to be and stuff. So that kind of fits with the story, doesn't it? Would anyone like to offer their analysis? What was the purpose? What do you think might be the purpose? Could there be a purpose? Well, anyone want to suggest? Would Saint Abinoub appearing in front of his altar serve a purpose? Can you just get a microphone and let us know? I notice this side's being really quiet. You are allowed to speak on this side. Please feel free. Yeah, go ahead.
Like a possible purpose for this would give faith to all the people that go to that church. If I was part of that church and that was an actual miracle that happened, I would, like, it would be like a revival in the church and everyone would have faith and they'll be so proud of Saint Abinoub and their church and that it happened in their church. But can I just ask a question about this as well? Does anyone know who took the original picture? Like, and are they vouching for this?
That is a very perceptive question. I thought the same thing. And so I actually asked Abuna Pavlos, who's the head priest of the church. Would anyone like to say anything else before I tell you what he told me? But just use a microphone if you could. That's what happens when you sit in the middle there, I'm sorry.
The reason why I'm asking for the purpose, it wasn't just for stating the obvious, but because I think there weren't any people in the church. There were no congregation during the photo being taken.
True.
And so the miracle becomes a miracle only to the person that was taking the photo. And so.
But isn't this evidence that everybody else can see?
Well, not for me. I'm still Christian, but I'm still skeptical of the image.
Why are you skeptical? And please forget that you saw the cross, okay? Why are you skeptical?
Because it didn't happen to me personally, I suppose.
Okay. So you're going to kind of... So are you using the human
argument?
Yeah,
I know Photoshop as well.
Hmm?
I know about Photoshop as well.
You know about Photoshop? Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Okay. So, go ahead. Oh, sorry, before we go on to Michael, while you're passing the microphone down, actually don't pass it down yet because I want to ask you. If, let's say, you trusted me implicitly, okay, trust me, I'm a priest, okay, if you trusted me implicitly and I said to you that I'm the one who took the picture and I did not use Photoshop and yet this is how it turned out, would that change your mind? Not me, because you're going to be embarrassed because I'm standing here in front of you. Okay, let's say it's, I don't know, your mum. Okay, let's say your mum is the one who took the picture. And she tells you, I took the picture and I haven't touched it and here it is. Would that change your mind?
It's more likely for me to be more swayed because it's very personal. It happened to... like influence me and everything, and it gets a bit subjective, but at the end of the day I'll still question it.
Okay. Anyone here who would say I wouldn't question it at all? Would you like to tell us why? Yeah, why wouldn't you question it? If it was your mum who told you she took the picture, would you implicitly trust your mum? Sure she's not going to lie to you?
Yeah, I do trust my mom. Like, I would.
Sure,
I just wouldn't have a strong reason to not to.
Okay.
Like, we obviously believe in saints and
yeah.
before it happened, so why wouldn't it have happened now? Like, I wouldn't have a strong reason not to.
Okay, good stuff. So we'll go to Michael at the back there. You may need to come forward again.
Point on Yussi's statement. If it was a miracle to just one person, that doesn't mean it's not. It could still be a miracle to one person. Like, there are personal miracles every day. So.
Sorry, can you keep that one near the back and use this one? Welcome to User
Defense. We were having a conversation at the beginning of the meeting, and I mentioned that the only way I can believe that this is a miracle is if it actually happened to me. So it's always personal.
I wouldn't have an input. Like, I was just thinking to myself, what would I think about it if it was brought to me by Richard Dawkins and he was entirely convinced that it was true and he was like, no, that's it, I'm changing my life and all of that stuff. Like, you know,
that would be a miracle. Okay, what if you took the photo? You stood there. No, Yussi. What if you were the one who was standing there, you couldn't see anything in real life, you took the photo, you went home, you looked at the screen, there's St. Abinoub in the picture. Would that convince you?
Yes.
That would. Okay.
Yes.
Yes, I would have to agree. Any other comments on this side? Nothing? Okay, So I did... go ahead. Yeah, Justine. Yes, that's what I'm going to complete it now. So I did actually ask Abuna Pavlos about this picture. His response was, oh, yes, I know that picture. I know the guy who took the picture, and he actually told me that he photoshopped it. Okay? That's why there's a cross there. Okay? Now, I will point out that if it hadn't been for me having access to that very specific piece of information, and in fact, before I spoke to Abuna Pavlos, I was really 50-50 about it. But when I got access to that bit of information, obviously that sort of decided the whole thing, made it very obvious in the end. Okay, so, however, that doesn't, you know, again, just because this one turned out to be false, doesn't necessarily mean that every other picture in which a saint appears is going to turn out to be false. You can see that you know, you're not justified in jumping to that conclusion. There may, in fact, be some in which it's real. Okay, our third and last case is, of course, the apparition of St. Mary at Zaytun. Oh, okay, sorry, it was a guy's daughter. Sorry, thank you. Someone just correcting me there that it was a guy's daughter. Okay, so St. Mary's apparition in Zaytun. For those of you who are too young to remember, you probably heard about it anyway. Way back in the 1960s, if you're interested in this, there's a really, really good book that's really, really hard to get a hold of. That's the book, A Lady of Light Appears in Egypt, and they mustn't have printed very many copies. When I looked it up on Amazon today, they had copies going from anywhere from $70 to $200, apparently. It's just a paperback. But usually when a book is really rare and you can't find it anywhere, then people charge exorbitant prices. But if you ever find it become cheaper or if you have some money to invest, it's a really good book. It's written by a Coptic fellow who's a professor of something or other in America, together with an American fellow called John Jackson, who is an engineer with a PhD, and his wife. And the Coptic fellow basically collated all the evidence for the appearance of St. Mary, as in eyewitness reports, official reports, government, you know, church and so on, newspaper accounts, photographs, you know, all the evidence he could get together. The engineer fellow took some of the photographs and did a scientific analysis to find out whether they were frauds or not. And keep in mind, this is back in 1968 when it started. Photoshop, back then was where you took your film to be processed, you know, the Photoshop. there was no, people didn't have personal computers. If you had a computer back then, it was this huge cabinet at university, and all you did is put in punch cards and get punch cards out. That was, you know, the limit of computing back then. So he did this very careful scientific analysis of the photographs. We're going to have a look at one of them in a little while. He also went with a team and surveyed over 100 witnesses to find out whether their accounts matched up. And from his survey of over 100 witnesses, he came up with what he called the standard vision, which is what most of the people agreed on, if you can put it that way. There were some differences in what people saw. We might discuss that a little bit later. But most people agreed on what they saw. So it happened way back from 1968. St. Mary started appearing on the 2nd of April, I think it was, and continued to appear on and off for about 2.5 years. At its height, she was appearing 2, 3, 4 times a week sometimes. Sometimes she would appear just for a few minutes and then disappear again. Sometimes she would stay for hours. I think the longest apparition that I read about was about 2.5 hours, that she just stayed there above the dome. Of course, hundreds of thousands, probably millions is not an exaggeration, of people went to see her. The church is a small church surrounded with a wide street in which you could very easily, I've been there, and I think probably some of you have been there, I could have easily imagine fitting in maybe 40 or 50,000 people around the church, all with the ability to see the dome. And if you imagine that happening pretty much every night for 2 years, 2.5 years, I don't know what that works out to, but that's roughly how many people would have been there. She didn't appear every night, so not all of those people saw her, but a pretty big proportion of them did see her. Not only that, this was the photographic age, so some people actually took pictures, and also it was in the news, you know, all over the world as well. Okay, so let's have a look. First of all, I'm going to present to you the evidence. What I'd like you to do as I'm going through this evidence is maybe, just for fun, be a bit of a skeptic. See if you can find the holes in this story. Is this, you know, are there holes to be found? Okay. The first witness who saw her was a Muslim. He was a chap called Farooq Muhammad Atwa. Was that Atwa? I don't know. Atwa? Okay. Farooq Muhammad Atwa, a lovely Muslim name. He was a motor mechanic working across the road, and the story goes apparently that he was just doing his work or whatever, looked up, saw what he thought was a young lady on top of the dome about to commit suicide. So he ran and said, "Don't do it, lady, don't do it, you know, don't kill yourself." Started calling for help to come. People came, they saw her as well. They called for the police. The police came, they saw her as well. At first, they didn't know what to make of it. And apparently the original reports were, you know, we don't know what this is, but it's something. And of course, as you know, in Egypt, the word gets around really, really quick. Egypt perfected the art of spreading the word way before Facebook or Twitter or any of those things. And up until today, it's a much more efficient system, may I say. And before you knew it, there were thousands of people coming to see this bright, shining lady above the domes, including, here are some people who saw her. The president, the Muslim president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Pope Carolus VI, of course, who also put out an official statement from which we'll read an excerpt in a second. And large numbers not only of Christians, but also of Muslims and foreigners, you know, in brackets, of all persuasions and types and backgrounds. Here are some of them, and I've listed these names just to show you that this is not just one or two oddballs, you know, saying they saw something. Here is a list of highly respected, very decent people who hold high positions in respectable institutions who you would never question if they told you anything natural had happened. Okay, they have no reason to lie, including Cardinal Stephanos, the primate of the Coptic Catholic Church in Egypt, a Jesuit priest called Dr. Henry Habib Ayrut, I'm guessing, the Reverend Dr. Ibrahim Sayed, of the head of the Presbyterian Church in Egypt, Remember, Presbyterians are Protestants who don't really care that much for St. Mary. Okay, why would he be interested in this? A whole big group of the nuns of the Society of the Sacred Heart, a Catholic institution. Father Joseph Malsoum, I don't know what the letters stand for, a Maronite Catholic priest. So that's quite a lot of pretty good, respectable witnesses who, in this book, state that they saw St. Mary, that it was an apparition of St. Mary. Here are some of the actual, this is the wording of some of the accounts. So this is a chap called Wadia Tadros Shambo. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Please help me with the Arabic. Is that Shambo? Is that a common name? Not really. Okay. He is an engineer and he is Protestant. Okay, so he's an Egyptian Protestant. And this is what he says. A thin line or edge of light appeared, like the light you see when you open the door to a lighted room, I think that should be. Within seconds, it formed itself into the shape of the Virgin. I could not speak. All who were with me said, "It is impossible." This sight lasted for 5 minutes, when the figure rose and vanished. I could distinguish only a difference in color between the skin and the face, the hands and the veil. There was some color in the face and the hands. It was evident when St. Mary walked back and forth. When she disappeared from our side of the church, the people from the other side shouted that they were seeing her. Okay, what can we gather from this account? Oh, a question. Yes, please, go ahead. But use a microphone.
Missing the argument, because I suggested this miracle to an atheist friend of mine, and he said, I looked up at it, it's just a light. You see a light, you can see a light in whatever shape you want to, see that light. And clearly, the respectable people, they were all Christians, and Muslims also believe that the Virgin Mary is in their Quran.
Yeah.
So, how do we know, is there any purely objective way of seeing, an agnostic or an atheist who saw it and saw, this is a lady who's on there, not just some sort of light appearing.
I think we have a response way at the back there. I don't know if the microphone will reach.
Yeah, but...
Will the second microphone reach over there, or do you want to... Thank you. Oh, where's the other one gone? Still way at the back, is it? Okay. And did you want to say something on this side? I saw someone saying something. Okay, yes, we've got one at the back, so if we can get the other microphone up there while you're talking. Yes, go ahead.
Just on that, the Muslims don't really want
to... Microphone, microphone.
The Muslims didn't really want to admit that it was St. Mary, even though they do believe in her, because obviously it's a Christian miracle. My mum's from that age, and she told me, heard years ago, they actually shut down all the electricity in the area just to disprove that, you guys are just making something up. Yeah. It was a government-led initiative, but obviously she still appeared. They did everything in their power to disprove it at the time.
Perhaps the sceptic... Oh, sorry, go ahead, at the back first, Samuel.
Oh, I just wanted to throw in that... I'm not sure what your name is sitting next to you, so you were saying that are there any, atheists or agnostics who saw St. Mary at Zeytun? And I do have on my computer, if you're interested, it was published in a journal by... She was a humanities professor in the American University of Cairo who went with a Coptic friend, and she does say that she saw something, and I can't remember exactly how she worded it, but it was very interesting. She saw the light appear, and I think she was saying something like, I had trouble focusing on it for a while, but it looked like a woman, and I couldn't believe that it was a woman because I was an atheist, so I was having trouble accepting the fact that I was seeing a woman. But there was definitely a light there, because this was published in an academic journal. So, people who were Christian and not Christian and Muslim and whatnot were seeing an actual light. And then, I don't know, you'd have to analyze her wording closely if you want to see if that's an example of an agnostic who actually saw a woman. But, there was something there. Yeah, I do. I can post it. I think you can access it from JSTOR if you're at uni currently. You can pay for it. I'll post up a link on the website.
It'd be good if you can put a link. Yeah. Is there... Okay, I take your point, or the atheist point who said it to you, but... What would they say about an account like this? Someone Okay, I agree that you could see a blob of light, and like you see bunnies in the clouds, you might see a woman in the blob of light. You have to answer two questions. One, where is that blob of light coming from? Now, remember, this is a blob of light hanging in the air, in empty air. Today, we don't have the technology to make a holographic blob of light like that. Today, in 2013, we can make a holographic image of a woman, but it has to be inside glass walls. That's how the technology works at the moment. This is 1968. How are you going to get a blob of light that stands, you know, it's not solid as in you can touch it, but it doesn't float around. The wind doesn't, you know, break it up into little pieces or something. It's coherent. It just stays in the same shape for up to 2.5 hours. Not only that, okay, maybe distinguishing a face, which is what he says, distinguishing hands, maybe that's his imagination. But then he says, she walked. Walking is a movement, a purposeful movement. Would a natural source causing a blob of light walk? I wonder what the atheist friend would say. Or anyone want to comment on this? Okay, yeah, Michael.
Sorry. But I don't know about the walking bit. Who went to say the light moved? They might say the light moved.
Okay. Okay. Let's go on to the next one, okay? I think what we can take from it is, okay, you're going to have to stretch things a little bit to fit it into a non-miracle model. It sounds a bit odd. Okay, yeah, go ahead, Michael, before we go on, but please use a microphone.
Saying the whole thing is a lie. Like, you're still acknowledging that they're with you on that they saw a lie.
Yeah.
They're just going to say the whole thing was made up by the Egyptians.
So okay.
There was no lie.
Do you think that can stand, that the whole thing was just a massive, massive hoax? What's the evidence against that?
What's to say it wasn't?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Who's to say it was? Oh, yeah, it wasn't a hoax. Yeah. Yeah, why should we say it's not a hoax? Anyone? I'm happy to answer, but yeah, go ahead, Mina. Yay, we've got someone on this. Oh, we've got a second person on this side. Very well done. Go ahead.
I mean, there's obvious answers that there's Muslims and, you know, eminent people that have seen this. There's photographs. There's huge amounts of evidence to show that's not a hoax. But in the end, I think Michael's right. For someone with a naturalistic worldview, like that quote said, it's more likely for everyone to have light, even though it may seem that it's not in the best interests of the Muslim, the president, the government, whoever else is involved. It's obvious that they wouldn't lie about this, but that it's still more likely that everyone involved has lied than this miracle to have happened.
So now let's, you know, go back to the probability of this. What we're proposing here is that something over 1 million people, most of whom have no connection with the other rest of the 1 million people, who've come from all different religions and backgrounds, have somehow all agreed to tell exactly the same lie, most of them benefiting absolutely nothing from it. Okay, how likely is that? Okay, what's the probability of that happening? Has that ever, ever happened in the whole history of the world? So using Hume's own argument that we have never seen something happen before, therefore it cannot happen now, he disproves his own assertion that this would be a hoax. I think people who say it was a hoax and everybody was just lying, they're not living in the real world, okay? You might want to, we'll discuss some of the other possible theories, which are also weird and way out, but that one I think is just totally off the board. Yep.
What if it was like a big national marketing campaign by the tourism industry in Egypt or something?
Okay, so
like the Egyptians built the pyramids, which is something.
The cardinal of the Coptic Catholic Church and priests from America who have nothing to do with Egypt except that they were interested in this and came to see it. They're all going to get behind the Egypt Tourist Board because it's such a worthy cause. I don't know. I'm not convinced.
The pyramids were built.
Yes, over here, but with a microphone, if you could.
I don't believe that it was a marketing campaign, but just to play devil's advocate, what if it was the government who did want to do this marketing thing, like let's bring foreigners who are mainly Christian to Egypt? The Christians obviously would want to believe it. They wouldn't be in on it. So they see it and believe it, and everybody else believes it because that's what the government would want them to think. Okay. Like, that's a plausible conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I don't know if you can really
I don't believe
plausible
in myself.
And conspiracy theory in the same sentence.
I believe most miracles, but I'm just saying, like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. But, again, let's ask, what was it that they were seeing? What was the source of this light? Where is it coming from?
I'm no master... like illusionist.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So sorry, but just politically at the time, Christians were suffering persecution. They were going through a very, very hard time, I think even from the Pope to the bishops to the priests to the church as a whole. So I think if we're going to look at miracles and the purpose, if God does them, then it's really to support his people, and that links in. But definitely the... you know, government won't subsidise doing something when they're already against the church.
Yeah, no, it's good to ask those questions because that's how we get to the truth. You know, you test a question out and you see if it makes sense.
I'd just like to say I believe in the miracle.
Yeah, no, I so do I. I'm going to give this one a tick. I've never found a video, but I think there are good reasons for not finding a video. Number one, video cameras in 1968 were not that common. The second thing is I do a little bit of astrophotography, which involves using a camera looking through a telescope to take pictures of really faint, you know, objects in the sky. And I can tell you it's really, really hard. I'm actually surprised that they got even those pictures like the one that we're going to see. It's incredibly fiddly to get the aperture and the exposure time and all that sort of stuff right so that you don't overexpose it and just have white or underexpose it and just have black. Okay, there's a very small region in the middle where you actually get the details of a picture. So the fact that they got that, all these pictures were taken at night when everything is really dark, you're really trying to catch little tiny bits of light onto film, you know. So it's much harder with a video camera too, because video cameras back then were not as sensitive as the film you have in a still camera. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. You won't find a lot of dark video from those days. You know, they hadn't, I don't know if they had or not, you know, infrared imaging is what you usually see now on TV. That shows you, you know, where a room is fairly dim or dark and you can see everything. And you actually need to use an infrared camera to see what's going on. You can't use a normal, you know, video camera to do it. This was dark. It was night, basically. And I don't know, people said that her brightness was roughly the brightness of the full moon. It's not that easy to get a good picture of the full moon. Try it with your iPhone tonight. There's a moon out there. It's going up at the moment. I saw it as I was coming in. It's not about distance with photography. It's about the contrast between the dark bits in the picture and the light bits in the picture and getting the settings right so that you catch the contrast kind of thing. Justina.
Sorry. I'm pretty sure that we have a VCR at home with a footage, like video footage of this. I can actually look for it these holidays because I've got nothing else to do. But if I do find it, I will bring it in. But also, just to disprove something, like some witnesses saying that it was just a ray of light, like you couldn't see anything like outlined or anything. But can't you disprove that from the footage I've seen, and we have a picture of it as well, there were also doves like actually moving around her, and she's known to have doves surrounding her and everything. So wouldn't that just automatically disprove that because she's known to have doves surrounding her because of her purity and all that.
It would be so interesting to see that footage. I've never seen footage like that. If you can find it, we'd love maybe at the beginning of next month's apologetics meeting, we could just maybe spend 10 minutes to have a look at it. That would be so good. The doves I haven't mentioned because, again, putting on, you know, looking from a skeptic's point of view, you know, birds fly, you know, and people say doves don't fly at night. Sure, but if someone disturbs their nest, you know, they're going to fly around a bit. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure. It'd be interesting. That's why it would be so interesting to see the footage, to see if they look like natural birds flying or whether they look somehow different, in which case it might be more evidence that they're supernatural. I'm not quite sure about the doves. It would be interesting. Over here, Michael, if we can whiz a microphone over there, or whiz Michael over here. That's even better.
I'm just going to be a Christian skeptic. Why couldn't it be the devil?
Oh, why couldn't it be the devil making St. Mary appear? Good question. What do you think? Oh, okay. Yes, Mina looks very unhappy with this.
I don't think that there'd be any point for the devil to do this, since it strengthened the faith of so many Christians and probably caused conversions to Christianity. It sounds like a very great and loving thing for God to do, not something a devil would do.
He would be shooting himself in the foot to some extent. Yeah?
But, I mean, doesn't St. Paul also say that if an angel appears, don't believe? Wasn't there a demon-possessed girl that ran after Paul and said, these are the servants of the Most High God?
I don't think he actually said, even if an angel appears, don't believe. That was in the context of you have to test the spirits, particularly against right doctrine. And what he was saying, I think if I've got the right passage, is that even if an angel came and told you something different to what I'm teaching you, don't believe him. Okay. Whereas St. Mary didn't say anything. And if anything, the message that people took was very much in keeping, I think, with the Christian gospel. So we can probably disagree with you there, I think, with a degree of safety. Yeah? Microphone, please.
I would guess that the devil was unable to appear as St. Mary. I think as he appears an angel, he probably doesn't, we don't really know what an angel actually looks like, and probably just appears as something that he knows we might associate as being an angel. But it's like saying, can the devil appear as Christ, in the form of Christ? I think he'll kind of burn in just the purity of St. Mary and the whole remembrance. I don't know, it's my opinion.
It may be possible.
And just also on the footage thing, I think I have seen footage of doves around the aeroplane when Pope Carolus brought back the skull of St. Mark. So maybe I can try.
If you can find that too, we'd love to have a look at it. And actually there were some more recent apparitions of St. Mary, I think one in the 80s and another one just a few years ago. So if anyone can find video footage of those, now we have excellent equipment. Surely someone's taken some better pictures and videos. If anyone has access, please let us know. Just wait until we get a microphone to you.
What about the lights that happen in Jerusalem once a year?
Ah, yes. Very interesting. That's another very interesting situation, which probably would have been a very good case as well to have a look at. So, of course, you're talking about the Easter light or the Saturday of light. That's why we call the Saturday before Easter the Saturday of light, because the Greek Orthodox patriarch, I think it is, goes into the tomb of Christ, and after some prayers, a supernatural light comes down and lights the candles. And then everybody lights their candles from his candles. And I love my mother too, and I believe that she doesn't lie. She actually went there, and she had they give you a bunch of 33 candles, like all in a bunch. So she lit her candles, and she saw people putting their hands in the flames and putting their face in the flames, and she thought, this is odd. And so she, My mum's a bit of a coward. Okay. She held her hand right up the top first and very slowly, slowly brought her hand down, and she said, until her hand was actually sitting in the flames. And she held it there like for a number of seconds. And no burns, no injuries, you know, no anything. That's actually a really good example of a, you know, people could actually go and test that miracle. And I actually have seen some videos on YouTube of people in Jerusalem. And they're doing crazy things. They're like, you know, washing their face with the fire, you know, of the candles and smiling at you, you know. That is a very good example, yes. Anyway, back to this. Let's have a look at a few more eyewitness accounts and then continue our discussion. So this is a Father Jerome Palmer, a Benedictine Catholic priest from Indiana, USA. And this is his description of what he saw. There she was, 5 or 6 meters above the dome, high in the sky, like a phosphorus statue, but not stiff as a statue. There was movement of the body and of the clothing. I stood for 1 hour from 4 to 5 o'clock a.m. looking at the figure. It never disappeared. Our Lady looked to the north. She waved her hand. She blessed the people. Her garments swayed in the wind. Now, you remember the Vegemite Jesus that we saw in the lid of the Vegemite jar? Okay, that you can be pretty doubtful. This is a lot more detail, okay? He's seeing her wave her hand. He's seeing her turn so that her face appears in a different profile. He's seeing her garment wave in the wind. That's an awful lot more detail. Can we attribute that just to the wiring of our brain seeing patterns where they aren't? Or have we got to the stage where, yeah, Tony? But with a microphone, if you could. Wait on, we'll get the microphone across. Or you come to the microphone, either one.
At the moment, the evidence that you've been giving us, that the more consistent or congruent the witness's worldview is to ours, the more detail they provide as to, even by their suggestion, they've already thought that this person is St. Mary just from the outset, rises some suspicion.
So you're saying because they already believe it's St. Mary, they're kind of reading these details into
it? Well, not only that, but the way they read her movements, she blessed the people, her garments swayed, and it's kind of like as if they're reading into what they observed, into what they expect to have found.
Okay. It's a valid point. It's a good point. I think in the end you kind of have to weigh up the level of detail compared with the suggestibility that you're talking about of the people. Okay, but let's have a look at some more. Now, this is from the official report of the Coptic Orthodox Church released about a month after the apparitions began. So this is just to give you an idea of how wide-ranging it was. The apparitions were witnessed by thousands of citizens and foreigners of different religions and denominations, clergy, scientists, professionals, all sorts of responsible people who declared with absolute certainty that they saw the Virgin. Many of them agreed on the shape of her appearance, its time and location. The papacy, in issuing this statement, declares with absolute faith and certainty that the Holy Blessed Virgin Mother of Light has appeared. And again, I'll just remind you that this is a church that, as I said, has maybe officially sanctioned half a dozen miracles in 100 years. So it's a fairly strong statement. Okay, there were investigations carried out by the Coptic Church, headed by Bishop Gregorius, who's passed away as well, a very well-known scholar, known even outside of Egypt, of very high integrity, if I can put it that way. The Cairo police force, not a very nice institution, but they ran an investigation and could not find any kind of, you know, anything to disprove what was happening. And the Roman Catholic Church, when the Pope heard about it, sent his own personal envoy to check it out. And he came back and gave the Pope of the time a positive report that he thought it was a miracle. There were media reports all over the place. There are just a few American newspapers that were listed in the book who carried the reports. And we come to the photographs. Okay, so now we've got to the stage where we don't just have to take the testimony of other people who might be suggestible, maybe not. Okay, let's look at the photographs for ourselves. I've only brought one of them, which I think is one of the best ones, though. This is a photo taken by a Coptic fellow called Fawzi Mansour. And this is one of the pictures evaluated in the book that I was telling you about, like scientifically evaluated. And I've enlarged it here so you can see it a little bit better. Unfortunately, the only picture I had time to get was off Google. It's actually on the Wikipedia article about the apparition of St. Mary. So there are probably ones with better resolution, but that's not too bad, I think. Okay. Now, when this guy actually analyzed it, he noted a number of things that he thought point to its authenticity. And I've given you two examples there. One of them is if you look at the bottom of St. Mary's dress, and I don't know if it's visible on the screen so well, but you'll notice that she seems to be standing behind one kind of wall of masonry and yet standing in front of another wall of masonry. Can you see that down the bottom? If I can, yeah. If you look on this, the ceiling of the dress comes down, and it's in front of this wall, and it's behind this wall. So that this wall places down like that, she's hidden by it. But this wall, she finds it, goes behind the next. So, What the fellow is saying, did you hear what I was saying without the microphone? Okay, so what this fellow is saying is that's a very subtle detail. You'd have to be an incredibly clever hoaxer, you know, to do that. Another thing that a hoaxer probably wouldn't think of is he analysed the intensity of the light at different points in the halo around the head. And what he found, you can't see it so well in this particular picture. In the book, it shows a lot better. It's a much higher resolution photograph. And what he found is the intensity of the light increases as you get closer to the center of the halo. And it increases according to exactly the right formula that you would expect from a globe of light. So if you think of this, at the edge of the globe of light, there's only a tiny bit of substance, whatever it is, that's producing the light there, so the light is not so intense. In the middle of the globe of light, you're seeing right through the whole diameter of it, so there's an awful lot more light in the center. And it's a really simple, you know, mathematical formula to work out how the light should taper as you move from the center to the edge of a globe of light. You following what I'm saying, or have I lost people? Anybody lost? Okay, so if you imagine that I had a ball of light, alrighty? So the whole thing, including its insides, imagine that every atom in this solid ball was producing light, okay? But it's transparent, so the light from the middle gets to shine out as well. If I look straight at the middle of that ball, I'm seeing the light that comes from every atom along a diameter of that ball. So that's an awful lot of light. It all adds up, okay? If I look at the edge of the ball, all I'm seeing is the light from a few little atoms which are just on the edge there. So that the edge should be a lot darker than the center. And you can work it out mathematically according to the volume of each slice as you get closer to the edge. Okay, how it tapers, the light gets dimmer as you go towards the edge. Does that make sense? And apparently when he analyzed this picture of the halo and the intensity at different points, he found that the intensity of the light follows the formula you would expect from a globe of light. Now, that would be a really hard thing to fake, particularly back in 1968. Even today, that would be, you know, pretty hard to fake, I imagine. You'd have to work out the formula and then somehow, I don't know how you do it, use Paintrop or something and do it dot by dot or something like that to make sure that you follow the formula. Back then, they didn't have computer programs and software and all that sort of stuff. They would have had to have found it, you know, and that's a lot of thinking to put into it, to put into, you know, who would have thought that anybody would think to do that analysis of the picture? So this fellow, who's an American fellow, I believe he's a Christian. He's obviously not Coptic. He's some other kind of Christian. But he uses evidence like this to suggest that this is a genuine photograph. It hasn't been doctored in any way. Any comments or discussion on that so far? I don't know what we've got left. Okay. Anybody wish to say anything or question or be a skeptic? Okay, yeah. Tony, over here. Sorry, if we can get a microphone, that'd be really good.
Well, why was that analysis needed if the photos could not be doctored at that time?
Okay, you couldn't doctor it on a computer. What you could do, see, again, I love saying this, you're too young to remember probably, back in the days of film, okay, you could go in the laboratory. You can get two negatives and put one over the other and then develop that. You can do stuff like that. Okay, any other? Okay, let's move on. We've almost got to the end. Actually, we have got to the end. So we'll skip the surveys, but they did a survey of over 100 eyewitnesses, as I mentioned before. Okay, I think we might finish with this and then just have the conclusions. This is David Hume talking about miracles. And I put this up here because we're going to read through it very quickly and compare it to the miracle of Zaytun as we've just seen it. Okay, so this is what David Hume, the skeptic, says. There is not to be found in all history any miracle attested by a sufficient number of men. Okay, here is a miracle where we have over a million people probably who saw it. Of such unquestioned good sense, education, and learning. Again, we had a whole list of people who are all of those things, and Catholics and professors of universities and so on. As to secure against all delusion in themselves, of such an undoubted integrity as to place them beyond all suspicion of any design to deceive others. Conspiracy theories apart, you know, of a million people who don't know each other all agreeing to say the same lie, okay, that seems not to count here, or, I mean, we do have that. They're beyond suspicion. And of such credit and reputation in the eyes of mankind as to have a great deal to lose in case of their being detected in any falsehood. A point that we didn't make. If this was a hoax, the people who perpetrated it ran the risk of being found out. If Pope Corollus was behind this, you know, the whole Coptic Church would be ridiculed if it was ever found out. That's quite a big risk to take. And at the same time, attesting facts performed in such a public manner. So David Hume is saying miracles always happen in private. Miracles never happen in public. Well, guess what? This one happened in public. And in so celebrated a part of the world as to render detection unavoidable. In other words, he's saying it always happens in some corner of a backwater that nobody ever goes to. Well, here we are in the middle of a city of probably 12 million people back then where everybody could see it. All of which circumstances are requisite to give us a full assurance in the testimony of men. So if, David Hume, you are saying that if you have all these circumstances fulfilled and satisfied, we can have full assurance in the witness of the people who saw the miracle, then I propose to you, Mr. Hume, that in the miracle of Zaytun, that is exactly what we have. So I wonder what David Hume would have made of this miracle. I suspect he probably would have been like Richard Dawkins and still clung to... Okay, here's some other theories. Okay, I'm just going to share with you a very quick personal opinion. I think anyone who says it was a hoax, it never happened, people just made it up, there was nothing there, they're silly. If they say to me something like, it was aliens from another galaxy who came and found out that we're Christian and pretended to be St. Mary, that's a bit more likely. Okay? If they came and said to me that there is some really strange, unknown natural phenomenon that makes a blob of light appear and look like a woman who waves her hand and whose clothes wave, maybe I'll consider that as a possibility. But we have a third option, which is it is a general miracle in keeping with the beliefs of a third of the population of this earth, which seems to me a lot more likely than aliens or really spooky natural phenomena. Okay, so how about I put this up? We've got a lot of conclusions and our time has run out. We can take maybe one very last question, and I'll put this up on the Facebook page for people to peruse at their leisure, and feel free to be a skeptic and attack, and we can have an interesting discussion. Very last comment before we close.
Okay, so it's not a question, just on the wiki page where you got the photo from, it says at the bottom, the Zaytun apparition has been investigated as being a possible example of the tectonic strain theory.
Yeah, I didn't bring that up because that's one of the really crazy ideas, okay? Here's the idea. Earthquakes happen in a particular part of Cairo. They create certain kinds of static electricity that somehow coalesces to form the shape of a woman. Three or four times a week, on a regular basis, in exactly the same place. And the static electricity waves its hand at you. I leave it to your judgment. Okay, thank you, everyone. It was a miraculous night. Next month, we're back to the last Sunday of the month once again. Our topic will be a question that's come up a lot in the last 2 years, but we always touched on it but never really delved deeply into it. This is the question of why is there something rather than nothing? How can we explain the fact that things exist? Do they bring themselves into existence? Or do we have some other clever way of getting around the whole thing? That'll be the question we'll be looking at. If Justine or Michael happen to find their videos at home, we may spend the first 15 minutes or so having a look at them just to sort of complete our topic for today.